Well, thanks very much, Hugh. I'm Matthew Watson from the University of Warwick, but probably more interestingly for you, formerly a member of staff at Polsys. And Hugh set us a number of questions that he would like us to at least reflect a little bit about. And the first one was how we came to IPE. Well, for me, it all started here, and it all started in a complete fog of not knowingness. Because I was asked to teach the third year IPE module, the one that I presume quite a lot of you are sitting at the moment, a week before term began in my last year as a PhD student. My predecessor had decided that he wasn't going to be teaching it that year, and the department was in a very big hole. They had absolutely no idea how they were going to cover that teaching, and they asked me. I think they asked me primarily because I was well known then, and probably still am now, for not being able to say no to anything. So I duly agreed to take on that teaching. I went back to my office, I sat at my desk. I think I probably felt sneakily proud of myself that still as a PhD student I was being given my own module. That pride lasted for probably 2 minutes when it dawned on me that I didn't actually know what IPE was, and that I got less than a week to get to learn what IPE was, otherwise I was going to be in quite a lot of trouble. My students at that time, or the students that were coming back to start the term in a week's time, they clearly knew more about IPE than I did because they'd had the advantage of already studying it for a year. I was absolutely clueless. So you can imagine where I was, which is severely compromised by my own ignorance, and I was significantly further behind than you are now. And so I was faced with a set of students who look very much like you do now. Probably don't anymore, because this is quite a while ago. They'll all look much more careworn and beaten down by the vagaries of life than you do at the moment. But they knew what IPE was, I didn't. So you will already be much further forward in your studies of IPE than I was when I first began to teach it. So I had a week's worth of panic, thinking that I was at a severe disadvantage even compared to my own students. However, I spent the next 15 years of my career reflecting upon this and wondering whether it's actually an advantage rather than a disadvantage not to be introduced to IPE through the introductory textbooks. Because if that is the limit of your IPE knowledge, it constrains the sorts of questions that you can ask about the world. It constrains the sorts of knowledge that you can create about your own lives as well as about other people's lives. So I'm actually now extremely glad that I had that formative moment of panic, that sense of really not knowing what I was doing, but then a subsequent realization that that might actually not have been too much of a bad thing after all. So I've been able to carve out both a teaching and a research profile for myself within IPE, unencumbered by having been taught it myself in the first place. So I was never socialized into a particular view of the subject field that comes through the textbooks. I've always been allowed to do it my own way. And I'm in a very fortunate position at the moment that the ESRC has awarded me a professorial fellowship to continue doing it my own way and to try to think about the different ways in which IPE might be researched and also the different ways in which IPE might be taught. So I taught it back in my first year in the post. That was even a different century to the one that we're in now. Necessarily as an outsider, because I was an accidental IPE theorist in the first instance, I probably still am an accidental IPE theorist now. And I think I continue to teach IPE as an outsider, although I do this rather more on purpose now than I used to in my early days. And there's something really rather curious about IPE. If you look at the way that it's taught and you look at the way that it's researched, there can be quite a significant gap between the two. Most IPE modules, perhaps all of the introductory IPE modules, follow the textbooks and give you a really rather orthodox introduction into the various positions from which apparently you can access IPE knowledge. But hardly anyone in this country actually does their research like that. So I think there is an element of schizophrenia that runs through the IPE community in the UK. The way that we teach our students the basics of IPE is not reflected in the way that we do IPE research ourselves. We are much more critical, much more radical, much more free thinking in the way that we do our research than it appears in the way that IPE is taught. I think this is something that's actually really rather interesting, and it might be something that we can try to discuss in front of you this afternoon to see whether we've got any good answers for you in this respect. It's as if we get, I guess, completely overpowered by the idea that there must be an orthodoxy out there, and the only way to teach the basics is to teach it through the orthodoxy first. And then when you get to your third year, perhaps when you go on to graduate study, you can do all the exciting stuff that circles around the orthodox approaches. But you could set us a test today. You could ask us to name all those people operating within IP in this country who operate in their own research from those orthodox positions, and we wouldn't get very far. We wouldn't be able to name many people at all. Ask us the other way round. Ask us who criticises this orthodoxy in their own research, and we could bang on endlessly. We could name everyone that's employed in IPE in the whole country, and they would probably fit into that category. So what we have with IPE is something very curious, I think. It's an orthodoxy that we tend to set our own research up against, but I think it would be fair to say that it's an unpopulated orthodoxy. We tend to assume, don't we? We tend to assume that wherever we can identify an intellectual orthodoxy, that's not only the established position, but it's the majority position as well. I really don't think that's the case with IPE, certainly not the way that IPE is conducted in this country. I think we're faced with an unpopulated orthodoxy that we still pay far too much respect to in the teaching that we deliver and the modules that we organise. I think we could help you as IPE students if we were to wash away this pact with the devil that we seem to have engaged in of giving undue respect to this unpopulated orthodoxy. What I would hope would happen in the future is for IPE scholars to teach IPE more in the way that they research it. And in this country, at least, it's researched overwhelmingly in an exciting way, a way that tries to bring more voices into the debate, that tries to complicate orthodox notions of economic agency, that gives respect to a whole vast array of different ways that people live their everyday lives. That is the way that we research IPE in this country, and I really wish it was also the way that we taught it. Let me give you just one or two examples of what the major differences might be then between the way that we research IPE in this country and the way that we teach it. Well, in the way that we teach it, through the textbooks that promote orthodoxy as the first route into the subject field, there's a much more restricted conception of the agent, there's a much more restricted conception of agency, and there's also a much more restricted conception of how particular agential characteristics are brought into being. If you look at the IPE textbooks and you compare those to the way that IPE research is conducted, you would get the idea that these are two completely different subject fields, because the one simply doesn't match onto the other. So what do the textbooks do? Well, the textbooks typically focus either on the state or on a state-replacing body as the agent. To be able to identify agency in IPE, it's usual to be told in the first instance that you must be able to seek a body that has an obvious source of political authority to rely upon, and that political authority is encoded in law, is manifested in institutions, and that it's those sorts of bodies and those sorts of bodies only that become the agent. As for agency, I think there's a straightforward conflation in most of the orthodox accounts between agency and interest. So to be able to identify agency taking place, you have to firstly identify the prior understanding of interest to which that agency is oriented. And when you put these two things together, I think you find that orthodox IPE, as reflected in the textbooks, is based on some simple sui generis statements that a state must act on its own interests, because unless it acts on its own interests, then it isn't acting as a state. And not only the state, but any state-replacing body, any institution that represents a formal site of political authority, it must have identifiable interests in the first instance, and it must be able to act on those interests and only on those interests, otherwise it's not doing its job that it's prescribed to do in the first place. There is, of course, an inherent circularity that's involved in this respect, and it's an unhelpful circularity as well. We get trapped into, I think, a false chase that requires us to be able to search for interests and to be able to reduce everything to interests. I think that a lot of everyday economic activity is conducted in really rather different ways, and a much more complex understanding of agency is required in that respect. So, I suspect I've got just 2 or 3 minutes left to go. Is that right, Hugh?
You are, yeah, fine.
Maybe the first question to ask in this respect then is, where might this restricted conception have come from in the first place? The textbooks are interesting again in this respect because they tell a particular history of IPE. 1970 is generally used as a cut-off year. Pre-1970, which for some of us includes us, some of us on the panel, not all of us, two of us, the old people on the outside. For the old people on the outside, our origins are pre-IPEs. The IPE apparently emerged out of nothing into a whole that was created in 1970, and it emerged almost fully formed as a body of scholarship that simply needed to be fleshed out. So in intellectual terms, 1970 acts as some sort of year zero. There's nothing before it, everything comes after it. But where does the teaching of IPE generally come in the student syllabus? Well, in the first instance, almost all introductory courses in IPE are taught as an aspect of international relations programs or international studies programs. So it's taught to reflect what you already have learnt in the first year in international relations, and it's also taught to reflect the founding assumptions that were there at the moment of IPE's birth, which are also the founding assumptions that were there in international relations in the 1970s. So you have a conception of IPE where it's simply the economic aspects of world order that are accessible to us using conventional theories, methods and approaches of international relations. So there are only certain questions that you can ask, and there are only certain views of the world that you can reflect in the work that you do within IPE. And if we look at intellectual histories of IR, I think it's less than coincidental that most of those points of the 1970s as being a very, very fallow period in IR theory. An IR theory that was being reduced to a series of perhaps unhelpful core principles at that time, but then get reflected at the moment of birth in IPE, in IPE itself. There are alternative ways of looking at IPE, of course. There is a political economy approach to IPE that we could try to develop if that's what we wanted to do. My own work is almost overwhelmingly in the history of economic thought, and I suspect that there will be moments during the discussion when I tell you some things about the history of economic thought that you think are frankly bizarre and that you'll forget the moment that you walk out of the door, but which really interest me and which really keep me going in the job that I do. Now, if we look at the history of economic thought as an alternative route into IPE, we learn a number of things. The first thing we learn is that there's no such thing as an intellectual year zero, that subject fields don't are never born fully formed. They're always in the process of becoming and of being reproduced. They're reproduced in different ways for different reasons. There are contested histories of what counts as starting points and how those starting points are overlaid subsequently. I think a deep study of the history of economic thought tells us two further things as well. It tells us about the struggle that was entailed in silencing many viable alternatives along the way, and it also tells us about a number of intellectual myths that grow up to try to form the impression, or even enforce the impression, that intellectual history is a simple linear progress through which good theory drives out bad theory. All of this is complete hogwash. None of this is actually how intellectual history develops. And it's always important to go back to the starting points to see what the debates were at the time and how those debates have subsequently been reformed to fit what we might think is true today. So intellectual history works in two directions at the same time. There's the bad way of telling intellectual history, which is to assume that we have all the answers today, and we look to our forerunners simply to try to tell us how we got to where we are today. The better way of doing intellectual history is to think of how theories form and to think of the political context in which those theories form as well. If we do that, then we provide for ourselves, I think, much more complex understanding of who the agents might be within IPE. There are any number of stories I could tell you about the history of economic thought in which significant struggles were fought as to whether the individual, social classes, or society as a whole should be the preferred economic agent within economic theory. There are also a huge number of complex discussions about the nature of agency within the history of economic thought. We think that there is a particular homo economicus today, the innately self-interested individual who chases utility maximisation at every moment of their lives. If I had the time, I could sit and tell you about 10 alternative conceptions of homo economicus from the 1730s onwards. All of these being different conceptions of what the economic agent is, applying different conceptions of the relationship between the economic agent and the society in which they operate. Now, all of this to me seems to reflect the interesting ways that so many of us do our IPE research. These are the sorts of foundational questions that we want to ask, and we can get at those foundational questions more fruitfully, I would suggest, if we consign the textbooks to where they belong, which might be as some sort of starting point, but not a starting point to take particularly seriously. Thank you.